Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, new research finds Arizonans' health is being affected by climate change more than residents of other states. And what's behind the increase in threats against politicians? But first, the ongoing federal government shutdown means around 900,000 Arizonans who rely on federal aid to buy food will not get that assistance starting on Saturday. Governor Katie Hobbs has sent a letter to the U.S. Agriculture Secretary urging her to use $6 billion in a contingency fund to pay for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. But the Trump administration has said it does not plan to do that. This comes on top of reports of furloughed federal workers visiting food banks as they miss paychecks. And consumer price index figures recently released show grocery prices in September were 0.3% higher than they were in August and more than 2.5% higher than in September of last year. With me to talk about all this is Terry Shoemaker, Executive Vice President of the Arizona Food Bank Network. Terry, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks so much.
So let's start with this pending SNAP funding situation. What is the current situation in which food banks around the state are finding themselves? Like, how are they doing?
Food banks around the state are coping as well as they can, I think, given what is around the corner for them, which is a massive increase in the people that they serve. We're going to see people who are used to getting SNAP benefits delivered between November 1st and November 13th coming to food banks instead.
And so is there a way to prepare for that?
There are a lot of ways to prepare for that, and our food banks are doing a really remarkable job, kind of going into what I would qualify as a disaster relief mode. We're used to standing up operations in a vacuum, and this is kind of like a big disaster that's happening to everybody at the same time. So it's something that food banks are well equipped to do is stand up extra distribution, stand up more resources. But at some point when one meal a food bank provides compared to five that SNAP provides. So for every one meal you would get from a food bank, you'd get five from SNAP. It's a really big gap.
Well, and are food banks equipped to stand up to, you refer to it sort of disaster, like to a situation like this where, you know, 900,000 plus people, you know, in a week could be coming in and needing meals?
Well, we call it emergency food network for a reason, because food banks are really, we see them as a place that you go to when you have no other options because all of the federal supports aren't there for you or you don't qualify. So really it's kind of, you know, the place you go when you have no other place to go. And a lot more people are going to have no other place to go. Now, having said that, some of that population that receives SNAP likely already visits food banks because SNAP is only intended to cover about 70 to 80% of your needs for the month. Mm-hmm. So that means there's a gap anyway in what SNAP provides versus what you need. And so whether your income covers that, because most people who receive SNAP work, if they're not children, and so your income doesn't cover that, SNAP doesn't cover that, what's going to?
What are you hearing from food banks in different parts of the state? Like, are some maybe more equipped to deal with what's coming than others?
I think certainly the larger food banks, so regional food bank warehouses like Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona in Tucson, St. Mary's Food Bank here in Phoenix, and United Food Bank here in Phoenix, those folks are more well prepared, I think, for this type of activity due to that kind of disaster response lens. You get to a Yuma Community Food Bank, which doesn't have as many resources locally, and things are going to be tougher to do more because they're already doing an awful lot in the community.
What are you seeing in terms of donations and outreach to try to solicit additional donations?
We need additional donations, especially large food donors and fund donors. It's really critical for food banks to get more support right now because quadrupling your business in a week, I mean, most retailers that have all the resources in the world wouldn't be able to deal with a fivefold increase in the course of 1 week with 1 week's notice. So, you know, retailers were approaching the holidays. They stand things up for the holidays over the summer, years before, you know, they know what they're going to be doing. And so all of this really came to a head last week when the USDA released guidance that SNAP wouldn't be funded for November. And that's when food banks really started working the phones, getting together. The good news is that food banks are very used to working together to find solutions to problems. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Well, you mentioned the holidays, and obviously Thanksgiving is coming up in about a month or so. I wonder, though, if that's even something that food banks can look at right now. And typically, that's a time of year when, you know, there are a lot of solicitations for Thanksgiving meals and extra food for, you know, to help people have a nice holiday. Is that sort of too far in the distance for food banks to think about when they're facing something much bigger, much sooner?
If SNAP doesn't get funded by November 13th, anyone in the state who receives SNAP will have been affected. So that's far before Thanksgiving. And so while we're already prepping for holiday mode, because in food banks, holidays start in July. So you have to start getting ready over the summer, you know, Christmas in July. But what they're doing is seeing Thanksgiving as they'll do what they normally do, the Thanksgiving distributions, the turkey drives, all of that. You're seeing that around the community now. It's just the things that we're going to have to do before then are going to have to take priority.
Even if donations increase and food banks are able to, you know, acquire more food, like how long can they meet this need? Like how long can food banks reasonably be expected to have several hundred thousand more customers?
Can I give you a negative number as an answer? Because that's what we prefer. And that's the truly heartbreaking part. Yeah. No one who works at a food bank wants to see more people needing a food bank. And for those of us who've worked in hunger relief for a while, this is unprecedented. This is worse than it was after 9/11, worse than it was after Hurricane Katrina. This is worse than it was during the height of COVID. Food banks are seeing a higher number of people today than they saw during the height of COVID, more than ever before. And that's before the SNAP funding problem hits on Saturday.
All right. A lot to think about there. That is Terry Shoemaker, Executive Vice President of the Arizona Food Bank Network. Terry, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Phoenix earlier this month hosted SemiCon West, a major conference of leaders in the semiconductor industry. The Valley has been working to make itself a hub for the sector. Officials say the more than $160 billion investment by Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing company is a big part of that. But other companies are also playing a role, including Intel, which has had a presence in the region for many years. The Arizona Republic's Sasha Hupka has written about this and what the Valley needs to do to continue its current momentum. She joins me now to talk more about this. Good morning, Sasha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So how big of a deal is it that Phoenix was the host of SemiCon West instead of a place like, I don't know, San Francisco?
So I think that the way to think about this is that this conference sort of legitimizes Phoenix's semiconductor hub, right? We've seen momentum behind bringing companies here now for years, including TSMC, which you just mentioned, kind of the juggernaut in that space. And this conference is sort of a global almost recognition of the fact that Phoenix has become the domestic semiconductor manufacturing hub.
So what does it say then? I mean, obviously, it's a big deal on the global scale to have this conference here. For folks who came here from outside of Arizona, what were they saying about the Valley sort of as a semiconductor leader?
Well, you got all the things, you know, people would usually say, right? The weather was beautiful. They totally lucked out. It was like
they weren't
the first
here in July,
week of,
we should point out.
Right. It was like the first week of nice weather in the fall. But really, I mean, this represents just a huge shift in the U.S. You know, San Francisco and the Bay Area in California has long been thought of as sort of the semiconductor hub. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing is while there are a lot of companies that are headquartered there, Intel is one of them. They're headquartered in Santa Clara. Increasingly, the manufacturing side is shifting here to the desert. And so I think for officials here, this was a chance not only to sort of like bask in the glow, right, of we're the big semiconductor manufacturing hub in the U.S. now, but also to start trying to draw more companies in because these companies like to cluster sort of together in a group. And so one of the focuses that they're going to have moving forward is sort of building this like end-to-end supply chain here.
Well, that's kind of been the hope for the area in North Phoenix where TSMC is, right? Like, yes, their factory is there, but also other companies, maybe suppliers, other related businesses all sort of end up in that same part of the region, right?
You see that with Amcor, right? I think they're a good example of this. They're not in Phoenix, they're in Peoria, but they're just a few miles down Loop 303 from TSMC. And their presence here and then later their expansion of their investment here, all of that is directly linked to having TSMC right up the road.
So what do folks say that Phoenix and the Valley need to do to sort of continue to build on this momentum? And it can't all be sort of, as my mom would say, lollipops and unicorns.
So I think there's a few things. The first, like I said, they need to kind of sort of continue to bring in these companies and build that end-to-end supply chain, right? I think Amcor is a good example of this. They do something called packaging and testing, which is sort of like the end process of creating a computer chip. And until they sort of get their factory up and running here, there's not really going to be a presence for that piece of the manufacturing process in the Valley. So that momentum in terms of bringing in suppliers and other related companies needs to continue. But I think that this also raises some really interesting questions around the sort of research and development end as well. Because in semiconductor manufacturing, one thing I've heard over and over again from experts is that it's not just about what you're doing today. It's about what you're going to be able to do tomorrow. You know, the world is in this global chips race because these tiny little computer pieces are integral to our ability to send emails and have autonomous vehicles and all of these futuristic technologies that are important for both our life today and in the future. And it's going to kind of come down to which areas and which countries can sort of keep up on designing new types of chips that enable more powerful technology going forward.
That would seem to speak to the need for education, especially maybe in higher education, in terms of preparing scientists and researchers and people who know about this to be able to do not just the manufacturing, but the research and development.
That's absolutely part of it. I would also say, though, you know, you mentioned the manufacturing, and that's a part of it too, right? There's also a workforce need. If you're bringing in all of these companies, they're going to need people to do the actual work of manufacturing a silicon wafer into a computer chip. And I think that that's where a lot of officials here see opportunities for Arizonans, because historically, our state has not been the most well-educated on the higher education level, but a lot of these jobs don't require you to be.
Does it seem as though the folks with the companies and in the industry, like, is the business climate here what it needs to be? Like, are the things that the Valley might need to work on, are they more policy things, or are they more like just we have to do this to get people up and running?
I think it's always both, right? You know, policy is reflective of what you want your outcome to be. And so I think that you'll see they need both. But I do also think on the policy front, there's going to be some interesting decisions that are also going to need to be made around data centers, because what you see is that data centers and AI are sort of driving a boom in the chips industry right now. And so there's this awkward reality as Valley officials on the local level, on the zoning level, tackle, you know, do we want data centers in our community? They use a lot of energy, they use a lot of water, they use a lot of space, and they don't create a lot of jobs, typically speaking. As they grapple with that value proposition, they also have to sort of grapple with the reality that that's what's driving this industry that now, you know, our region is sort of betting its hat on to a certain extent.
Yeah. Lastly, before I let you go, is there sort of a consensus on what the ultimate potential of this sector is? Like, what's the ceiling for the Valley in the semiconductor industry?
I can't speak for the Valley specifically, but I can tell you that at SemiCon, something that was repeatedly said was the idea that this is going to be a $1 trillion industry soon, before the end of the decade. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. And the Valley, in theory, will have some slice of that. The hope
is. And I think part of the reason this story is so important is because it's not just about now. It's about the future. And how do you get that piece of the pie?
Yeah, interesting. All right. That is Sasha Hupko with the Arizona Republic. Sasha, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear from a Valley artisan who creates upcycled Halloween decorations, including porcelain dolls with creepy face paint. But first, a new report that ranks states based on climate-related risks and how they impact human health has some not-so-great news for Arizona. The data from the Commonwealth Fund ranks Arizona 45th in the country. The organization has been evaluating state healthcare system performance for a while, but recently started looking at a new set of indicators to figure out how a state population's health was affected by the environment and specific climate-related events and disasters. In trying to figure this out, researchers looked at a state's geography, how they're doing in terms of enacting policies affecting health, but not only in the health sector, and how healthcare systems are responding in different states. Arizona scored well in a few areas, including the emissions produced by healthcare workers and the risk to healthcare facilities from natural disasters. But the state fared poorly in factors like air quality and health risk from extreme heat. I spoke recently with two of the report's authors, Matt Eckelman, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northeastern University, and Melanie Marino, a PhD candidate there. And we started the conversation by talking about how states can't really do that much about one set of factors, where they're located, but that they do have some agency over others. So I asked how those things come together to affect how well or poorly a state is doing. We'll hear from Matt Eckelman first.
Sure. Yeah, great question. And the drivers we were looking at, the individual indicators, you know, they're separate, but oftentimes there's interplay in the way they affect public health. So, for example, something that we found that was really important was the policy around electricity generation in each state. And this has an effect on the sorts of fuels that are used for power generation and the emissions from those power plants, and then the exposure to air pollution that people downwind have. So that's one indicator. But oftentimes pollution is exacerbated by heat. And so if you have both of these things together, you get even more health effects. So there's a synergy there. So even though, you know, indicator by indicator, we group them in this way, in reality, they're highly connected.
So, Melanie, let me ask you about Arizona specifically, which was ranked 45 out of the 50 states plus D.C. here. And it seems as though air quality was one of the main factors giving it kind of a low score. Anybody who spent a lot of time in the Phoenix area especially knows that the air quality is not great. What specifically did you find that led Phoenix to get the grade that it did?
Yeah, so for the air quality index, kind of looking at the granular data, we can look at the specific pollutants driving Arizona's AQI score. And some of those pollutants are nitrogen dioxide and also particulate matter from dust, industrial sources, and wildfires, and ground level ozone, exacerbated by constant sun and Arizona's hot and dry climate. But it's also important to mention, like you mentioned, Phoenix, Arizona, that this indicator is based on population weighted averages of county level AQI. So if there are a lot of areas in the state with really bad air quality and a lot of people live there, that's going to be given more weight because we chose to do this as we're focused on, you know, the health impacts on human health.
Well, and that is clearly the case in Arizona, where a vast majority of the people in the state live in the Phoenix metro area. And this area routinely has pretty well documented air quality problems. Sounds like what you're saying is that played at least some amount of a role in the ranking that the state had.
Yeah, definitely. And looking at the data, we saw that, you know, Arizona's most populated county, Maricopa County, only had 10% of recorded days in the year with good air quality as defined by the air quality index.
Matt, do you get the sense that there is, within the general public, a strong enough connection between the impacts of the environment on our health?
I would say a resounding no to that one. Yeah, there's many ways that the environment affects our health. And I would guess, even for me as a scientist who works on this, I still discover new pathways and new research that's coming out. And I think for the general public, there's a real underappreciation for both the severity of effects from the environment and also just the many ways that the environment affects our health.
What are some of the biggest ways that you think it would be helpful if people sort of understood that connection, understood that link?
Well, of course, people feel it, right? They go outside, they feel unwell if it's a high heat day or if it's a high air pollution day. You know, our bodies, our noses, our skin, you know, we're really good at sensing environmental risk. But there, what states can do and what states are doing that's incredibly helpful is having more sensing capability, monitoring environmental conditions, putting out alerts, don't go outside, better not to exercise today if you have a respiratory condition. So we're seeing more monitoring from states. We're seeing a lot more training and communication between doctors and patients about climate-related risks, and all of that's really helpful.
Melanie, I want to ask you about some of the areas in which Arizona actually did pretty well, despite its overall score. For example, it seems like, you know, there's not a lot of concern about natural disasters like hurricanes and flooding, things like that. There's also some energy efficiency areas, and it seems like the amount of emissions for healthcare workers going to and from work, the state does reasonably well. Are those enough? Obviously, you know, the heat and the air quality are significant factors against the state. But I wonder if some of the areas where you found the state doing pretty well, are those enough to start a foundation of trying to make things better here?
I would say yes. And I think a lot of these have to do with kind of healthcare system level interventions. You know, for the healthcare facility natural hazard risk index, it has to do where healthcare facilities are located. Are they located in areas at greater risk to environmental hazards? And also for the healthcare employee commuting emissions, are these healthcare facilities located in areas closer to centers of population with a greater connection to public transit infrastructure? And all these things kind of make a difference in building climate resilience and sustainable healthcare.
So is it safe to say then that those scores, like the ones you just mentioned, it's not necessarily just what the scores are, but maybe what they represent and the factors that lead to them? Like you were just saying, you know, maybe if healthcare providers don't create a lot of emissions or going to and from work, that's a sign that maybe hospitals and other healthcare facilities are near where people live, which is probably where they should be. It sounds like it's maybe more what the numbers represent in some way than what the numbers actually are.
Yes, I would agree with that.
The indicators are a small sample of what would be possible to measure, and they each represent a major issue, a major sustainability or environmental health issue that we see as important in the United States and the kind of variety that we have across our nation. One of the interesting things we've seen, of course, we're evaluating states, but within states, of course, there's a broad range of performance and a broad range of actions that people are taking. So in some states that are subject to these high hazard events or, you know, risks of some sort related to geography, they, of course, know it, right? They know that it floods a lot. They know that there's a lot of high heat. And yeah, so those are areas of the country where you're seeing a lot more adaptation action. You're seeing responses on the ground from local governments. And so those are lessons that other states can actually look to, even though where they fall in the rankings, you know, doesn't necessarily tell you who's on top and who's on the bottom. We're all trying to learn from each other. And what we hope to do in the future, as this scorecard gets put out and revised periodically, is that we're going to be able to see how states are doing over time. That's going to be a lot more important. It's going to tell us more actual useful information about performance than comparing states against each other. Each state's unique, you know, has its own history, its own constraints, its own, you know, culture. And so looking over time, it's going to be also pretty valuable.
Matt Eckelman is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northeastern University in Boston. Melanie Marino is a PhD candidate there. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says he will not open campaign finance complaints against political candidates who use campaign money for security. That announcement came in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination. As my next guest reports, social scientists say they've seen an increase in the number of threats and incidents of harassment of public officials since 2017. Carl Smith is a senior staff writer for Governing magazine. He joins me to talk more about an article he wrote about this subject. And Carl, are the types of threats and acts of violence since then similar to what we'd seen before, if maybe in larger numbers?
I think there are more threats, for sure. I even received a death threat about a story I wrote about a policy matter. I think in that context, though, it's really important to emphasize that it's almost like an inverted triangle. You know, the width of and the breadth of rhetoric is wide. The number of folks who would actually act on that rhetoric is still very, very small. There's a group called the Polarization Research Lab that just did a survey. I mean, it's just a minuscule number of Americans would actually do anything violent, even though they might answer a survey question that says, do you believe violence might be necessary? It's still not the norm, but the noise is much, much louder.
Well, the noise louder, and certainly some of the acts have certainly been pretty dramatic and unfortunate. I mean, you think about, the murder of Charlie Kirk. You think about the murders of a state lawmaker in Minnesota, the attempted assassination of a state lawmaker in Minnesota. You think about the arson at Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's official residence. Like, these are pretty high profile incidents.
They're horrible. I'm not saying that things aren't happening. I just wanted to underscore it's still not everybody who's willing to do that. But there are things that foment that kind of behavior that could and should be addressed and corrected.
Are there events happening that maybe we don't hear quite so much about? Like, are there threats or actually acts of violence that don't make the headlines?
Well, threats for sure. There's a Bridging Divides initiative at Princeton. They just did a survey. They found about 300 threat and harassment incidents involving, local government officials just in the first half of this year.
Wow.
There are more ways to do it, too. There are email, social media. There's more channels for that kind of communication. So it's not going down. And it's surprising who all is affected. It might be less surprising for a politician who's out campaigning all the time to get some pushback, but it's happening to teachers, it's happening even to police, it's happening to election officials, even public health officials.
Yeah. Let me ask you about a quote that you have in your piece from the author of a study about this topic, where they asked, what should be done about this? Folks basically said, both Democrats and Republicans, both sides of the political aisle, need to say this is not acceptable. This is not okay. This doesn't have a place in our society, in our country. It seems as though, at least to some extent, that tends to happen after these kinds of events. And yet, as you report and as we all know, these kinds of events continue to happen.
Right. Well, unfortunately, at the political level, in that world, attacking the opposite side has been seized upon as the most effective strategy.
So does that indicate to you that just sort of toning down the rhetoric, trying to not say the kinds of maybe inflammatory things or inciting things that people in politics tend to say, that maybe stopping doing that isn't enough to end this?
Well, it won't end if there isn't less of that. But it's interesting, there's a group called the Polarization Research Lab. I may have mentioned that they just did an interesting survey. And the way they look at it, the big threat isn't violence, because almost no one will do that, but it's that folks will give up in fundamental freedoms for protection against the possibility of violence, if that makes any sense.
I'm also curious about whether or not there's a consensus to some degree about some of the, I guess you could call them, practical steps that folks in elected office might take to try to protect themselves. Things like, you know, having extra security or being careful about what they post online, or, you know, not having a, you know, a bumper sticker of their kid's school on their car or something like that. Like, is there a sense of whether things like that work, or if they're just things that don't really make much of a difference?
No, I think it could work. I think there's agreement about restricting access to personal information of office holders. So it, in some cases, you can't restrict it altogether because where they live is part of their eligibility for office. But making it harder to know exactly where people live, you know, who their children are, maybe not posting what they're doing on social media in case somebody's watching them. So it's harder for people to know where they are and what they're doing. There are some folks thinking more about not allowing firearms at rallies or campaign events or whatnot.
Let me ask you about an effort that you wrote about from the Carter Center that includes folks in Arizona, where there's a network sort of led by a Republican and a Democrat to try to basically build trust and foster conversation in this country, in the political system in this country. Can you tell me a little bit about like what they do and sort of what the results have been that they've seen?
Sure. In essence, they're just fostering connection and conversation among people who think that the basic concepts of our democracy make sense and want to stick to them, you know, who don't doubt that election officials want to do a good job, who don't doubt the integrity of those people or their processes, and just get those folks talking to each other and also communicating more about how things work, you know, opening the doors between those people in the community and people in government so that they can work together. Because it, again, as I've said earlier, it's just not true that when you get to the level of citizens that they violently disagree. The violent disagreement is being used, unfortunately, for political aims.
And yet, though, there are polls. There's a poll that came out not that long ago that suggested a not insignificant percentage of Americans thought that political violence might be necessary.
That's true. However, as the Polarization Research Lab said, almost none are willing to commit it. So what do they really mean by that? You know, I think they mean they're frustrated. And one of the things that's fueling that, again, is this divisive rhetoric that makes them afraid. So they may be thinking violence is necessarily because the other guy is going to be violent toward them. So I might have to be violent in return. It's just, it's a something that feeds on itself to no productive end.
Carl Smith is a senior staff writer for Governing Magazine. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Lots of Americans experience more inflammation in their bodies as they get older. Researchers, in fact, have a name for it, inflammaging. But new research from ASU suggests it doesn't have to be this way. Scientists studied two communities in the Bolivian Amazon, the Chumane and the Mosaten, and their relative levels of inflammation as members of those communities got older can tell us something about aging in this country. Jake Aronoff is a postdoctoral researcher at ASU, where he studies immune function and aging. He joins me. And Jake, let's start with these two communities you studied. What about these two groups of people made them the right folks to be comparing against each other for this research?
Yeah, so much of what we know about health and aging comes from studying people in the U.S. and in Europe. And we've experienced a great deal of lifestyle and environmental changes over the last few hundred years. So that can contribute to a lot of health problems and accelerated aging. And so it's hard to understand sort of what human aging and human health in later life used to look like before we lived these modern lifestyles and experienced these modern environments.
So in a sense, by looking at groups of people who have not sort of gone through the kind of modern changes that we have, it's almost like looking at a blank slate kind of thing?
Yeah. So we can look at these populations. So the Chimane, for example, they are forager farmers in the Bolivian Amazon. So they have a great deal of physical activity. Just to give you an idea for comparison, Studies in the U.S. find that Americans on average take about 5,000 steps per day. The Chimani average a little bit over 15,000 steps per day.
That's
They're
a lot
much more.
More
physically active. Dietary studies have found that they're consuming minimal caloric excess, much lower saturated fats, processed sugar, processed food in general, compared to Americans. And so they can provide this model of what does health and aging look like with basically optimal levels of physical activity and optimal diets.
So what you found is that in that population, they had less inflammation in their bodies as they got older. Is it too simple a conclusion that diet and exercise are the keys to reducing inflammation?
I would say that is a large portion of it. So we focus on is this concept called inflammaging, the development of chronic inflammation in later life. And this is both a result of aging and disease as well as a contributor to aging and disease. And so we wanted to answer the question of do we see the development of inflammaging in the Chimani when you have high levels of physical activity and these relatively healthy diets. And so what we did was we looked at a collection of pro-inflammatory immune measures. You can measure them in blood to see if they increase with age. And we found very minimal increases with age, very minimal inflammaging, suggesting that inflammaging is minimal in this population. And so the reason we studied the most at 10 was a potential critique of that finding is that these samples were measured in our lab with a particular assay technology. And so maybe it's just there's some sort of measurement problem going on, and that's why we hardly found any evidence of inflammaging. And so then we looked at the Mosetan. The Mosetan are a neighboring population of the Chimane. They used to be part of the Chimane until a few hundred years ago. They split off with missionary contact. And they've experienced more acculturation, more market integration. And so their lifestyles are kind of this in between the Chimane and the U.S. And so then we predicted that with experiencing some level of lifestyle changes, a little bit less physical activity on average, a little more caloric excess and consumption of processed food on average, that we would see more pronounced inflammaging in the Mosetan. And so we have these samples from the two different populations, and we measured them at the same time in the same lab to rule out this potential measurement problem that might just be specific to our lab. And we found clearly more pronounced inflammaging in the Mosetan.
So what does this tell you about, for us living in the U.S., like maybe what we should be doing to try to reduce inflammation and inflammaging?
Yeah, so diet and exercise is a huge part of it. And that's something that kind of we already knew.
Yeah.
And so this finding is really reiterating that if you can increase your physical activity, reduce your caloric excess, reduce consumption of processed foods, that can go a long way. The other potential component that's going on is that the Chimane are exposed to a lot of parasites, in particular hookworm. And that might be another piece of this puzzle that's protecting them from inflammaging. So infection with parasites can contribute to these effects on your immune system that can be anti-inflammatory.
Now, I would imagine you're not going to advocate that here in the U.S. we all sort of get ourselves hookworms. So, like, is there a way to maybe take the beneficial properties of them that can help reduce inflammation without all the negative effects that a hookworm or any worms can have on people, other parasites?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not at all advocating people infect themselves with hookworms, because the other component is that your immune system develops in early life in a particular way for a particular environment. And so a Chimane person's immune system developed in a different way than someone in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And so you introduce hookworms to those different immune systems, they might have different effects. And so because your immune system developed in the U.S., you might have a bad reaction to a hookworm infection.
It kind of sounds, what you're suggesting here, almost like a vaccine or like an allergy shot, right? Where like you give somebody a very small dose of something that they don't want as a way to build up the immune system. Is that sort of on the right track there?
That is a possibility, yeah. I don't do that kind of research, but yeah, that's definitely a potential. The other factor is that parasites can alter your metabolic function. And so that could be another route through which the parasites influence immune function.
So do you see then that sort of the key takeaway from this research is, as you referenced, kind of confirming what we already knew in the sense that healthy diet, good amount of exercise, like not being too sedentary, that kind of thing, as we age, that becomes more and more important to sort of stave off inflammation, inflammaging?
Yeah. So there's definitely a lot that we can do that's within our control to offset and slow the development of inflammaging.
What would you like to figure out next? Like, what's the next sort of follow-on from this research that you think would be helpful to sort of continue our understanding of this?
So, on the one hand, we're going to be looking at – so lifestyles are rapidly changing in that area. People are consuming more and more market-derived processed foods. Physical activity is going down a little bit over time. And so to look at how these lifestyle changes are leading potentially to more pronounced inflammaging. We're already seeing it in the MOSA 10, and we might soon start to see that in the Chimane. And then the other part is to study these hookworm infections to see how they influence immune function and inflammaging.
All right. That is Jake Aronoff, postdoctoral researcher with ASU. Jake, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
We are firmly in spooky season with Halloween just a few days away. And to celebrate, my co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with a local artisan who specializes in spooky art year-round. Ashley Pennington turns reclaimed wood and preserved pumpkin stems into glow-in-the-dark Halloween decor, but she also makes some eye-catching gothic keepsakes, creepy dolls, and we mean creepy. These are mostly antique porcelain dolls that are each upcycled and unique, complete with what's called corpse paint. You know, the white face and black eyes of someone in the band Kiss, or maybe the Valley's own Alice Cooper.
It's funny because Kiss is the most mainstream, like, idea that people get when they see the dolls and the face paint.
Yeah.
But it's funny because Kiss is so disco. And the corpse paint that I'm inspired by is more black metal oriented. And black metal has, like, Norwegian roots and, like, decades of lore behind it. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I want to get into that in a moment, too. But, okay, you've brought many of these dolls in here for us. They are painted. You've painted them with the corpse paint. But beyond that, I mean, they're sort of recognizable. These are, like, kind of, you know, beautiful, old-fashioned, probably antique porcelain dolls.
Yes, exactly. My goal is to not only have dolls, but also other antiques and figurines. I do that as well. Mm-hmm. But to take these things that might already be a little bit creepy, keep that essence of them, and then, like, resurrect them with their own style or whatever kind of speaks to me when I'm working on the doll. Mm-hmm. For example, one of them I based off of old pirates.
Ah, I can see that.
Yeah. She has pennies on her base, and she has skulls on her shoes, a crab on her necklace, hidden weapons, and a bird skull on her hat.
So you have various versions of these here, and we'll talk about some more of them as well. But let's back up for a moment and just talk about how you got into this, Ashley. You said you're kind of inspired by black metal. What's that?
Yeah, black metal is a genre, a subgenre of metal that is darker. Mm-hmm. It's a little heavier than, like, mainstream radio, but there's so much horror lore. And then, of course, there's not savory elements in there. And so there's a lot of research that I go through to make sure the bands that I reference, the face paint, if I have any inspiration from a band, I make sure it's not the methodology that they believe in. If it doesn't align with mine, I won't use that. So I'm very picky about what black metal I'll reference, but just the lore behind it is what really interests me.
So all of this is upcycled, right? Like, these are antique dolls that's, you know, all the materials are found or you have, right? Where do you get these old dolls to begin with?
Yeah. So first, I do partner with a local estate sale company.
Yeah.
When I would go to estate sales and thrift stores, there would always be things that would just sit on the shelves and like people look at, they think is cool, they walk by, they don't buy it.
Yeah.
And like it kind of hurt my heart thinking like someone loved that item. They spent X amount of dollars on it. They had it in their house for eons. Like grandmothers might buy their dolls and like it's pristine. You grow up seeing it. And then once you're out of that phase, where does it go?
Yeah. So what you're doing here is sort of, I guess, spiritual in a way, right? Like you talked about bringing these dolls back to power. You've talked about how you do some kinds of cleansing practices to make sure that there's no negative energy around them.
Yes.
How does that work?
So just being mindful of all like beliefs, of course. My personal belief is that there's more than just this physical realm. So when I get them in their original form, I'll let them sit outside for 12 hours, 6 to 12 hours to let them like get fresh air, like acclimate. And then when I start to clean them, like with water or vinegar, I'll like burn locally sourced Palo Santo or cedar or just different herbs that help cleanse energy and smudge negative stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to keep them as new in a form as possible to resurrect it.
Yeah. You've mentioned this idea when you spoke with our producer of a spooky community, right? Like that this fits into and that you're a part of. What's that look like? Is this a broad community? Is it online? Is it here in the Valley?
So it's a community I had no idea was here in Arizona until a few years back, getting into this and involved in art more. I call it the Arizona Horror Community. It's a bunch of vendors that are artists. And then you have another group who are cosplayers, and cosplayers, like, they dress in quote-unquote costumes but become the character, and they can go really in-depth with it. It's a whole other art form in itself. And then you have just the horror genre fans that are, they, if you're not an artist, you are a collector. And I've grown up. My birthday's in October, so I've always been a little spooky. I always like horror movies. Like, that's a comfort for me. But so there's more people like that out here.
That's fascinating, though. So, like, someone like me who, like, I can barely get through, like, Scream, right? how do you explain that to folks who don't understand that at all? Like, something that is scary or shocking or dangerous in a way is sort of comforting to you. How?
I'm not sure. I'd have to call my therapist to let you know. But I've also been a scare actor before.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, one of my characters was a porcelain doll. I was at the 13th floor a few years back, and I did 3 seasons back to back. And
scare actors, we should say, are like actors who work inside of a haunted house, essentially, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also known as haunt actors, where they dress up in costume and scare you.
So you like this scary stuff. I love that.
Yes.
Do you think people are ever surprised that somebody who's into creepy stuff like you is like, you know, this kind of bubbly person?
I do it. When I was younger, I wasn't as nice, and I feel like now I get the choice of how I want to be, and I think there's not enough kindness in the world right now, so I like to keep myself this way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very cool thing. Thanks. Ashley Pennington, the founder and creator of Sustainably Creative, joining us to talk about her creepy dolls. Ashley, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's an honor. Lauren, thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org, where you can see those creepy dolls if that's your thing. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.